talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're debating the life and legacy of one of the greatest landscape artists of all time, J.M.W. Turner, on this, the 250th anniversary of his birth. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Born in London in 1775, Turner was a child prodigy who grew up to become one of the greatest artists of all time. His mastery of light, colour and atmosphere transformed the way we view art and nature, and his work continues to captivate artists and audiences around the world. In celebration of the 250th anniversary of Turner's birth, the National Gallery of Ireland has undertaken an exciting exchange with the National Galleries of Scotland. Since the start of this month, 38 Vaughan Bequest Turner watercolours from the Scottish collection are on display in the Print Gallery in Dublin until the 31st of January, and admission is free. At the same time, the National Gallery of Ireland's Turner collection is being showcased at the Royal Scottish Academy in Edinburgh. In tonight's show, we want to find out about Turner the man, explore what his paintings reveal about his vision and ambition, and debate his artistic legacy over the past 2.5 centuries. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Anne Hodge is the creator of prints and drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland. She has created a wide variety of exhibitions, including this current exhibition, Turner's Watercolours, Scotland's Vaughan Bequest. Charlotte Topsfield is Senior Curator of British Prints and Drawings at the National Galleries of Scotland, and she's the co-author of J.M.W. Turner, The Vaughan Bequest. Niamh McGuinn is an artist and paper conservator at the National Gallery of Ireland. Well, you are all very welcome. And Charlotte, I might begin with you and a question about Turner on this, the year of the 250th anniversary of his birth. How significant an artist is Turner?
Well, Turner's a hugely significant artist. I mean, he's really a colossus of the British art scene in the 19th century. He was active as an artist for over 50 years, from the early 1790s through to the late 1840s. He was a hugely experimental artist, constantly pushing the boundaries in watercolour and oil painting and in printmaking. And he was also, he was a self-made man as well, which I think is really important. His father was a barber and wig maker, and he became this hugely important Victorian figure entirely through his own hard work and his extraordinary talent.
And Charlotte, he's closely identified, or he's known for his work on landscapes. Was that something that was seen as a significant area for artists before him?
Well, I mean, traditionally, landscape was perhaps rated lower in the hierarchy, below history painting, in terms of the sort of academic and collector's interest in British art in the late 18th century. And Turner really established himself as a sort of pioneer. A really important watercolourist working before him, obviously, but Turner, in his breadth of interest and in his entrepreneurial spirit as well, he was a great businessman, he set up his own gallery, really sort of forged a path in establishing the importance of landscape.
And in terms of his name, let's see, it's J.M.W. Turner, Joseph Mallard William Turner, but I think he went by William.
Yes, that's right.
And we know him as, we still refer to him, is it as J.M.W. Turner or just Turner?
Well, both really. I mean, he sometimes signed himself with initials. He didn't sign his work that often. I think William probably comes from the fact that it was his father's name. So there's a sort of affectionate family thing going on there with how that's how he was referred to. But I mean, the name Turner is internationally renowned. I mean, in this year of Turner's 250th anniversary, there are exhibitions happening, obviously, in Scotland and Ireland, but also across the UK. UK and in the United States, because Turner is a name that people really do know and respond to.
And Anne, we've talked about there, his father, the barber. His father seems to have been a big influence on his career and seems to have taken a huge amount of pride in his son's talents and success.
Yes, Turner grew up in Covent Garden near Maiden Lane. That's where the family lived. Famously, his father is said to have pinned up the young Turner's watercolour sheets around the shop for the clients and customers to admire and perhaps buy them from time to time. And I think Turner himself, the young artist, from a very early stage had a great business sense and cultivated wealthy patrons and really made money as he needed to do. In fact, Joseph Farrington, who is a Royal Academician and diarist, wrote of meeting Turner when Turner, I think, was in his early 20s. And he said that at that stage he was still living at home with his parents, which benefited both of them. And that he was had more commissions at present than he could execute and got more money than he expended. So he was doing well from an early age. And certainly Turner's father remained very close to the artist throughout his life. He kind of acted as his assistant. Anyone who's seen that film that was out a few years ago would see the close relationship that they had. He would have mixed paints for him and done messages and deliveries and so on. So yes, very important figure in his life.
And for someone who started off, you know, maybe seen as quite a conventional or a somewhat conventional artist, it's fascinating the way he then became this experimental, revolutionary innovator.
That's right. And it happened really quite quickly. So when he was very young, he was making these quite conventional works, line drawings, coloured in, if you like, landscapes of the scenery around the south of England. And some were reproduced as prints. But very quickly, he started to develop his own style and way of working. And in 1801 in particular, there's works in the National Gallery of Ireland's collection from a tour he did up through the north of England into Scotland. And it shows him just making really expressive painterly watercolours, quite rough at times. But what he's doing is he's trying to capture the effects of rain and weather and clouds, and he does it brilliantly. We have an incredible view of Edinburgh. And it shows just rain clouds coming in over the city with cows in the foreground. But there's a great sense of drama and just the majesty and beauty of nature. So, yeah, it was a very quick turnaround from being a pretty ordinary landscape artist into being the great innovator that we all love.
And Niamh, an incredible technique as well.
Yes, he was very innovative in his technique. He very expressive. In fact, as a paper conservator, our job is to note and to make kind of condition reports on each of the works that are in our collection. And often I'd say one of the issues is trying to identify what is intentional expressive marks that he would have used, like scratching out to bring up highlights in the paper. He would have started usually when our collection with a kind of a tonal wash on the paper and then brought the whites back out by scratching into the paper surface. And sometimes that can look a bit like damage. But so our job is often made a little bit more interesting in trying to ascertain which is which.
And looking at the materials and looking at the pigments that he was involved with, like, it's fascinating the way you're able to kind of almost deconstruct the way he was creating these works of art.
Yeah, there's been a lot of work done over the years on his pigments. I'm only one in a long list of people who've looked after this collection and who've studied it. My recent colleagues have spent a lot of time analysing and looking at the pigments very closely, either through microscope or non-destructive analysis like XRF, X-ray fluorescence, or UV and infrared techniques that'll tell you a little bit about what makes up the pigments. So a lot of his colours his palette has been identified that way. And also there's a lot of information in the Tate, Joyce Townsend, Dr. Joyce Townsend has had a lot of his raw materials, his palette, his pans of watercolour on hand where she can, she has analysed and has been able to present very clear and concise list of the kind of pigments he used. He was very innovative, again, in his pigment use. You know, as soon as something came out, he used it. I suppose he would have been very early user of cobalt blue in particular. But we have a list of what he has used. I suppose his blues, our collection, as I call it, our collection, has a lot of blue in it. So we have a lot of Prussian blue, smalt, indigo, some cobalt blue, a lot of yellows. His reds were madders, vermilion, iron oxides. What else could I... He didn't do very much with green. A lot of it was mixtures of blue and yellow in our collection. And his papers, I have to say, I'm very glad to say he was very traditional in his use of paper. They're all very fine wove, well, mostly fine wove Wattman papers from Turkey Mill. And so we are lucky because these are very good quality. And the fact that they have been protected for so long in the way they've been stored and kept, they're very, they're a joy to actually work with because the colours are still very vibrant.
And because you see them all the time, you probably get a bit, you know, you're familiar with them. But when people see them for the first time, they do have a quite powerful reaction and response to them.
That's true. I mean, it has become a bit of an annual institution coming to see them, and people do come very traditionally for that full month of January to several times sometimes. But it was only, actually, there was a couple of students in the studio just before Christmas, and I was preparing our watercolours for the trip to Edinburgh. And because I had them in the studio, I took them out and showed them to them. And they were doing a bit of a research into fading issues. And you just surprise sometimes when, because one of them was nearly moved to tears. And you just realize just how you get so used to being around these beautiful things all the time that you take them for granted.
Charlotte, let's talk about the life of Turner, because he seems to have been quite fortunate in the patrons who took an interest in his work and who supported him. He seems to have travelled quite extensively. Then the art critic John Ruskin really champions his works from about the 1840s on and really hailed his genius. And it meant that even though he was a somewhat controversial figure in his lifetime, he was also someone who was hailed as a great talent, as a great artist.
Well, he really was. I mean, he established the sort of working pattern of his life very early on. He would spend his summers on tours, first of all in England, then to Wales, then to Scotland, and ultimately extensive tours around Europe. And then he would spend his winters working in the studio, preparing watercolours for engraving and oil paintings for exhibition. So he was quite sort of organised and systematic in the way he approached his career. And he did forge key relationships with patrons. For example, Walter Fawkes, who was a Liberal MP and a Yorkshire landowner, who was a great Turner collector and was sort of buying things almost straight out the studio. And there are key moments where his reputation really becomes established. I mean, obviously, there are key things like receiving the accolade of becoming, first of all, an associate of the Royal Academy, then a Royal Academician at an unprecedentedly young age, opening his own gallery in 1804 to promote his work in London. But referring to Walter Fawkes particularly, I mean, well, Fawkes had a house in London and he exhibited his Turner collection there in 1819. And that was the first time really that many of Turner's views of the Alps had been seen by a wide audience. And they completely blew the critics away. I mean, the critics are calling him things like an astonishing magician in watercolour, because Turner's response to the Alps, and there is from his first visit in 1802, and there is a sort of stunning drawing of the Great Fall of the Reichenbach, in the National Gallery of Ireland's collection from that tour. And another key patron of Turner's was the Scottish landowner Hugh Munro of Navarre, who really only started collecting Turner's work in 1830, but became close friends with Turner, and they travelled together in Switzerland in 1836. And Turner generally travelled alone. He wasn't the most sociable character on his travels, but because he had a travelling companion on that particular tour, and there's several watercolours from that tour in both the Dublin and Edinburgh Turner collections, we have sort of anecdotes about his working methods and his approach to landscape.
And you've mentioned there his work, The Great Falls of the Reichenbach. Do you think that influenced Arthur Conan Doyle then when he was looking for a dramatic setting for Sherlock Holmes to take on his arch enemy Moriarty?
Well, I certainly wouldn't be surprised. I mean, there was a more finished version of that subject, which was exhibited at the Royal Academy. And there were sort of very big dramatic exhibition watercolours that Turner produced based on his sketches from his first tour of the Alps, which were widely exhibited. I mean, they really emphasised the scale and the drama of these sort of alpine precipices. So I certainly wouldn't be surprised if Conan Doyle was inspired by that.
And he liked dramatic events, you know, shipwrecks, or when the British Parliament was on fire in 1834. That inspired him to do a series of sketches that I think he was drawn to. Was it the colour, the drama, or the excitement of these events?
Definitely. I mean, he was certainly drawn to. There's a shipwreck off the coast of Hastings in the National Gallery of Ireland's collection, and he's interested in exploring human interactions with landscape and natural phenomena. So, you know, turbulent seas or flaming buildings. I think he also had an eye for what was sort of topical as well. When the George IV visited Edinburgh in 1822, which was the first royal visit in over 200 years, Turner didn't tell anyone he was coming, but he came to Edinburgh to record the great pageantry that surrounded that, because, you know, he did have this sense of what was topical and what people might want to see represented.
And he never visited Ireland, but there is one painting of Clontarf Castle. So how did that come about?
Yes, well, as Charlotte mentioned, he had a very close connection with a man called Walter Fawkes, who lived in the north of England. And Fawkes was married to a woman called Maria Vernon, and she was from Clontarf Castle. Her father was the owner of Clontarf Castle. And yes, this watercolour exists that shows the castle with a beautiful peacock in the foreground. That watercolour is in a private collection now. But what we think is that Turner made this watercolour from a sketch by another artist, possibly by Maria Vernon herself, and maybe gave it as a gift. Maybe it was from her husband to his new wife, or we're not sure exactly, but Turner certainly was never in Ireland himself. But he did have a close friendship with Thomas Moore, the great writer of the Irish melodies, poet and writer of songs. And in fact, at one point, Moore asked, I think he met Moore first in 1819 in Rome, but in around 1834, they were talking together, and Moore asked Turner to make some drawings of his home in Bowood in Wiltshire. And Turner basically said no. And he said, what about Ireland? He said, that's the place you're connected with. And why not illustrate the whole life? And I have always longed to go to that country, but am, I confess, afraid to venture myself there. Under the wing of Thomas Moore, however, I should be safe. But sadly, Turner never made that journey. But we do have the watercolour of Clontarf Castle.
Charlotte, I find it hard to get a sense of Turner the person, because I've read that he became increasingly eccentric as he grew older. He suffered from depression. He never married, but I think he had two children outside of marriage. And before his death from cholera in 1851, he seems to have been a somewhat enigmatic figure.
Well, yes, I mean, he certainly was. Famously, he sort of maintained two residences, under the name Colonel Booth. Mm-hmm. When he died, his housekeeper who looked after his main house and his sort of official residence in Harley Street, almost had to go and try and find him because she hadn't to find out what had happened. So he certainly was fiercely independent and somewhat enigmatic. I mean, I think as a person, you know, he's accounts of him are contradictory almost because he was working for such a long time. He lived a long life. So, you know, there's anecdotes from different points of his career. He could be immensely generous. Obviously he left his collection to the nation. He gave money to artists who were struggling financially. And he was capable of acts of great generosity to his friends. But at the same time, as a businessman, he was very hard-nosed and hard to negotiate with. I mean, his relationship with Walter Scott is an interesting example because they first worked together on a publishing project called The Provincial Antiquities and Picturesque Scenery of Scotland from 1818. And Turner was contributing watercolours to the project, but also had a financial interest in it. And ultimately, the project was a financial failure. But Turner was sort of alone of the kind of shareholders, was refused to take on the financial burden of its failure, and definitely leaving Scott with a rather kind of bitter taste in his mouth. But then later on, sort of in 1831, they work together again and they actually forge a friendship. And Turner goes to stay with Scott at his house at Abbotsford in the Scottish Borders. And two of the watercolours which are on show in Dublin at the moment are images of the estate at Abbotsford. And they're actually very poignant because although they're based on sketches made while Scott was still alive, by the time they were developed into finished watercolours, it was after Scott's death in 1832. And there's these sort of poignant references, very affectionate references to him, to his presence and his absence, with his sort of empty writing desk and his empty chair and his walking stick propped against his favourite place for reflection on the estate.
And sometimes people were critical and openly critical of the works. His famous piece, Snowstorm, was dismissed as soap suds and whitewash.
Yes, well, definitely. I mean, particularly his oils got quite a mixed critical reaction. I mean, one of his views of the Falls of the Rhine, there's three watercolours of the Falls of the Rhine on display in Dublin, but those were done in the 1840s, and 30 years earlier he'd done an oil painting of the Falls of the Rhine based on his first visit to Switzerland, and that had absolutely been slated by the critics. Again, they thought the sort of spray of the waterfall was too kind of dramatic and looked sort of showy and like soap suds and all of those kind of pejorative things that were said. And you have a feeling of him going back later on to kind of revisit the landscape which his representation of had been criticised, to kind of revisit it and beat the critics again.
To beat the critics. And Niamh, another review of Snowstorm criticised him for, on former occasions, choosing to paint with cream or chocolate, yolk of egg or currant jelly, but saying that here he uses his whole array of kitchen stuff, and complaining that you can't tell where the harbour begins or where it ends, and which are the signals and which the author in the ship, and these are matters past our finding out. So there were criticisms, including about the types of materials he was using for these works.
Maybe so, but I mean, earlier you mentioned about the person and his presence or absence. And I think one of the lovely things that you can see in some of the watercolours when you look closely are his fingerprints. Because not only with what he used, is how he used them. And he was very expressive. And you do find very nice little pieces of evidence of just himself in the watercolours. I don't think I'd be too concerned at all about how he used things, because it's just to such magnificent effect that I don't think he can be too critical.
And he seems to be kind of a shrewd, am I getting a sense that he was a shrewd businessman as well as being an artist, that he was aware he wasn't going to just do a load of artworks if they weren't going to also end up making him some money in the end?
Maybe so. I'm not sure that maybe some of the pieces I think are so experimental that I don't think that was done with a business head. There's very, very little pigment or paint on the paper. So, I mean, I think that takes a bravery. They look almost unfinished, but yet they're very pure and clear, and they're actually some of my favourites. And I think if you were really trying to appeal to the kind of more commercial end, you'd be trying to give your as much as you could rather than as little as you could possibly get away with.
And that's a brilliant point by Niamh, that, you know, it shows what's driving him, that even though he is aware of the realities of the world and what he could just be churning out things that would make him easy money and not experimenting, not leaving himself open to criticism, but there is an artistic passion that is fueling his ambition.
Yes, his joy and enthusiasm and excitement about both the landscape that he was viewing and the materials he was using is palpable in many of these works. And I think it's important to remember that we sort of go in and ooh and ah about these studies, but Turner would have been surprised that these were shown on public display, because these were his colour beginnings in some cases. As Niamh said, there's very little pigment on some of them. We enjoy them. They're right for our sensibility because we are used to the work of the Impressionist painters, and we have an appreciation maybe for abstract art and more expressive art. But Turner, you know, all of these works that he made, and he made hundreds of thousands of sketches, both little small pencil aid memoir just to note down something he'd seen while he's travelling through the Alps perhaps. Then sometimes he would work into larger sketches back at his inn wherever he was staying, or as Charlotte said earlier, in the winters back in London in his studio. And he would work away using these things that he had witnessed and recorded in his sketchbooks and putting them forward in more finished watercolours. So both sides were going all the time. He certainly had a great business head. He knew what might spark or pique the public interest. And yet all along in the background, he was creating art for art's sake, just for his own enjoyment. So that's one of the things I love about Turner. And the great thing about the collections in both Edinburgh and Dublin is that they span the whole of his career. So you're seeing the very finished, detailed, topographically accurate watercolours from the 1790s, and then you see these ethereal, expressive watercolours from Venice from the 1840s that are just visions of light and mist.
Well, tonight we are talking about the life, work and legacy of the great artist Turner, and we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be finding out all about those exhibitions that are currently running in Dublin and in Edinburgh. The one in the Print Gallery in the National Gallery of Ireland, running until the 31st of January. Admission is free, and we'll find out all about it after this. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the life, work and legacy of the great artist Turner. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Anne Hodge, the curator of prints and drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland. She's created a wide variety of exhibitions, including the current exhibition, Turner's Watercolours, Scotland's Vaughan Bequest. I'm also joined by Charlotte Topsfield, senior curator of British prints and drawings at the National Galleries of Scotland, and she's the co-author of J.M.W. Turner, the Vaughan Bequest, and Niamh McGuinn, an artist and paper conservator at the National Gallery of Ireland. Well, Anne, let's first of all talk about the Vaughan Bequest and this incredible legacy that I wasn't aware of, which involved displaying and exhibiting the works of Turner. And it had to be in the month of January, because, of course, we know January, it's dark. There can be problems with ice and roads and everything. It's kind of miserable and people don't have any money and it's kind of gloomy. And this is the time when Turner and his brilliant use of colours is made available to the public.
We're very lucky that an English collector, Henry Vaughan, decided to bequeath a beautiful group of 31 watercolours to the National Gallery in Dublin. He was a man who had no connection with Ireland, but he was very interested in the work of J.M.W. Turner and built up a beautiful collection. And he was very inspired by the writings of John Ruskin, who was Turner's great champion. And Ruskin famously talked about the damaging effects of sunlight on watercolours. And he railed about the 1857 Great Exhibition in Manchester, where watercolours were shown in a big Crystal Palace type building for 6 months, and many of them faded, particularly the pinks and blues, within the works. So Ruskin collected Turner's work as well, and he thought that collections should be divided and shown publicly in different public museums. Vaughan bore this in mind, and when he died, he decided to divide his collection of Turner watercolours between the National Galleries in Dublin, London and Edinburgh. And in 1900, a beautiful cabinet arrived in Dublin, and they were shown for the first time in 1901 in Dublin. And they've been shown every year since, with one gap because of COVID, sadly. But yet that idea of the watercolours being very fragile and delicate was something that Vaughan was very aware of. So in Victorian times, galleries were naturally lit. So January, of course, this dull, gloomy month, the light is at its lowest level and it only shines for a small part of each day. So it was safest to show the watercolours at that time of year. Nowadays, of course, we have wonderful conditions, special light levels and so on. We could show them at different times, but we don't. We adhere to the conditions of Vaughan's bequest that they should be shown all at one time in the month of January, free of charge.
That is incredible. So every January we have the great work of Turner to cheer us up. And the Vaughan bequest, it spans Turner's entire career. So we get to see the different stages and phases of his artistic development.
That's right. We have works that he made when he was basically a teenager or coming into his early 20s. There's a lovely group of works in both Dublin and Edinburgh's collections that he did in collaboration with another artist, Thomas Girton. These young artists were invited to the home of a man called Dr. Thomas Munro. He was a great collector of landscapes, and he invited young artists to come to his house and copy the drawings in his collection. So Turner and Girton was thought to have done the pencil outlines, and Turner then washed in the watercolours. They're quite simple. They're views that were done by other artists, people like John Robert Cousins and John Henderson. But this was part of the learning process for the young artists. And they'd actually be paid for their work. They were paid 3 shillings and 6 pence, and they were given a supper of oysters for their trouble. Very early works like that, quite accurate, detailed studies of scenes in Dover and other places on the south coast of England. And then the collection moves through, and you have works that he did in the 1820s that were meant for engraving, so they're incredibly detailed. We have a gorgeous scene in the Irish collection of the Mew Stone, which was a very dangerous rock off Plymouth on the south coast of England. And Turner shows it just, it's sort of illuminated. It glows white with these big dark clouds all around. And then later, of course, he was doing the views in Venice, very sketchy watercolours that just evoke the special light that is in Venice.
And Niamh, this exhibition is running in the Print Gallery in the National Gallery. Tell me about the Print Gallery.
Oh, the Print Gallery is a very special place, I think, in the National Gallery. It was kind of designed purposefully for prints and drawings collection. It opened in the late 1990s and 96, I think. And since then, it has shown a rotation, as Anne said, because watercolours are so delicate to light exposure. There's a rotated exhibition. Nothing's on permanent display there. But we were very lucky recently to refurbish the space. I think one of the kind of common complaints, if I can say it, about the Turner exhibition in the past was that they were so dark and you couldn't see them. And in the 2017-18, we had the cases replaced and the glass is very high quality, non-reflective or low reflective. The lighting is very purposely designed so that it gives as clear and as good a view as possible at a very low level. So they're maintained at 50 lux, which is just a measurement. All light damages, so even at 50 lux, there is damage happening, but it's apparently at the light level that our eye can discern different tones and all the tones. So that's why the lux level of 50 is specified and we adhere to it. But ever since we had the cases refurbished, we've had no complaints. So I have to say I'm very, very happy about that. It means then, I think, for the public that when they come in, they are seeing the watercolours really at their optimum. Even now, when we put glazed works in the cases, it doesn't cause the same problems with reflection and glare. And I think just in general, the space is... it's lovely. It can get very busy. And that's, I suppose, a product of the popularity of Turner. But as a space in the gallery, it's very special.
And Charlotte, at the exact same time, we have 30 watercolours from Dublin on display at the National Galleries of Scotland. It's in the Royal Scottish Academy building in Edinburgh. So what can visitors see there?
Well, we're really lucky. We're absolutely delighted that the National Gallery of Ireland have lent us Vaughan's Turner cabinet, his own original display cabinet and the original frames. So visitors to the exhibition in Edinburgh can really get a sense about how Vaughan would have displayed and looked after and used the watercolours himself. And of course, we are really excited to have Vaughan's watercolour of Edinburgh on display, probably for the first time it's in its history.
And it's incredible the way you seem to have that combination of his experimental works, but also some that are maybe bigger crowd pleasers and showstoppers.
Well, I think that's something that's really interesting about Vaughan as a collector. I mean, the two bequests to Ireland and Scotland, I mean, to me, they really feel like he thought about them and curated them. But as a collector, he was really interested in these experimental works. I mean, Victorian collectors typically wanted something a bit more highly finished, a bit more densely coloured, that looked a bit more like an oil painting. But Vaughan was really interested in the experimental works, the sketchy works, the works that show Turner's process and his thoughts. And it is one of the very special things about both Vaughan bequests that you can see those alongside the exhibition showstoppers, like the big watercolour of Heidelberg, which is currently on display in Dublin, which is a really sort of visionary late big Turner watercolour.
And that is interesting that you do have cities alongside then these sweeping seascapes, dramatic landscapes, that there is a great variety in terms of what you can see.
Yes, well, I mean, Turner was always interested in the human aspect of landscape, you know, in industry, in the sort of economic conditions of the people that lived there. A lot of the watercolours in both Vaughan bequests relate to print series. On display in Dublin, there's two works from the Scottish collection from Turner's last great print series, Picturesque Views in England and Wales. And they're really big, large-scale watercolours. There's one of Llanberis Lake and Mount Snowdon, and there's a view of Durham. And this is a print series where Turner was really trying to sum up all his thoughts and his achievements and his reflections on making landscape. But they do always have this kind of human element. And he's also not afraid to play with the kind of layout of a city. The view of Durham is slightly manipulated to make it look a more pleasing and poetic prospect.
And Charlotte, he clearly had this great love for Scotland. He loved touring Scotland. He loved painting Scottish subjects. He had that friendship with Sir Walter Scott. It does seem to be an important part of his creative artistic world.
Well, I think it really was. I mean, he came to Scotland six times over the course of over 30 years. His first visit was 1797. As part of a tour of the north of England. And his final visit was in 1834. And I think there were lots of different elements to keep bringing him back. I mean, one aspect was the variety of Scotland's landscape, obviously the city of Edinburgh, but the abbeys of the Scottish borders, and then the great mountains and the highland scenery, epic highland scenery. But also his life really mirrored the transformation of the travel experience in Scotland, because on his first extended visit in 1801, there was a limited number of roads, you know, access to certain places was difficult. But over the first 30 years of the 19th century, thousands of miles of roads were built and steamships were introduced to that, providing better access to Scotland's islands. So on display in Dublin is the fantastic watercolour of Loch Carruisk on the Isle of Skye, which Turner visited in 1831. And it's actually one of my favourite pictures in the Vaughan bequest, because it's only the size of a postcard, but it's so dramatic. It's the most wonderful evocation of threatening mountain weather and landscape. And really, access to that location was only possible because of the transformation of the travel experience in Scotland over those decades.
And Anne, although we don't have that same personal connection with Turner, we do have it through the Vaughan Bequest and through other gifts of watercolours from Turner that have been made over the years. And when you see the reaction that there was when the bequest first arrived in Dublin and then all these later gifts, it has meant that a bond with Turner has developed.
Definitely. And following on from the Vaughan Bequest, another collector who was called Stopford Augustus Brooks. He was actually from Dunleary originally. He was a clergyman, but he lived in London for most of his life. But he had built up a beautiful collection of Turner's prints, the Liber Studiorum series. He had a full set of mainly first dates, and inspired by Vaughan's generosity, Stopford Brooks decided to gift his whole collection to Dublin. And at that point, Dublin didn't have any prints by Turner at all. And these prints were really important because Charlotte spoke about how Turner was trying to sort of raise the profile, if you like, of a landscape drawing and painting. And his Liber Studiorum prints, it was kind of inspired by the work of Claude Lorraine, who he was very interested in, the great 17th century French painter. And Turner set about creating this series of prints, all different types of landscape, and he hoped to produce 100. That never actually happened. He produced 71 that were published in batches. But anyway, Stopford Brooks had this wonderful collection, and there's a lovely quote in a letter he sent his mother on her 91st birthday, and he says, "I have just sent off the last batch of the Liber Studiorum to Ireland. My poor walls look very denuded and unhappy. I hope they will look well in Dublin and that they will interest the Irish. It will give me great pleasure to see them all someday and renew my friendship with them. And I like that far better than leaving them in my will and never seeing them in their new place." And certainly over the years, we have displayed groups of prints from that collection. And as well as Stopford Brooks, other people gifted Turner watercolours. We have five more beyond the Vaughan Bequest. And the last gift was a beautiful vignette, The Castellated Rhine, which was given by Clementine Lady Bight in the 1980s. The Bights famously gave the gallery the wonderful Vermeer and some other great old master paintings. But this beautiful little vignette filled a gap in a way, because we didn't have any of that particular type of watercolour from the 1830s in the collection.
Will people be able to see the works of Turner after the 31st of January if they visit the National Gallery, or is it just this month of January where the works are on display?
Just the month of January on public display. So if you turn up on the 1st of February, which is Saturday, they will be gone. The doors will be closed and we will be packaging up the works to go back to Edinburgh. However, Vaughan was very keen on his works being a sort of study collection. And the cabinet that we've talked about during this discussion, it has a little flap that comes down at the side. So the idea was that when the watercolours were not on public display, they would be kept in this beautiful cabinet. But students of art, people who were particularly interested in Turner, they could come, make an appointment, and the works could be taken out, placed on the little viewing stand, and they could look at them at their leisure. And again, this goes back to Ruskin, who felt that Turner was such an important artist that people should be allowed, other artists and people just generally interested should be able to learn and enjoy his work. So you can make an appointment to view the Turner watercolours beyond the month of January, but it's the main, I mean, they're on public display in January.
Okay, so the exhibition is running until the 31st of January. Admission is free. It's in the Prince Gallery in the National Gallery of Ireland, and it does come very highly recommended. Well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be assessing the legacy of Turner. Welcome back. We're talking history and we're looking at the life, work and legacy of the great artist Turner. I'm rejoined by Anne Hodge, the creator of prints and drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland. She's curated a wide variety of exhibitions, including the current exhibition Turner's Watercolours, Scotland's Vaughan Bequest. Also rejoined by Charlotte Topsfield, the senior curator of British prints and drawings at the National Galleries of Scotland, and she's the co-author of J.M.W. Turner, The Vaughan Bequest, and Niamh McGuinn, an artist and paper conservator at the National Gallery of Ireland. And I've heard Turner described as a precursor to Impressionism. How accurate is that?
I think that's very accurate, in fact, because his work is so expressive and he often is not trying to delineate exact details. He's trying to give an effect, an impression, to give a sense of the feeling you get when you look at a very beautiful scene in nature. And of course, the Impressionist artists, most notably Claude Monet, did exactly the same thing. And Monet was a great fan of Turner's work. And recently there's been exhibitions that have highlighted the works of both artists. And also an artist like Mark Rothko, he would have been very inspired by both the Impressionists, but also by J.M.W. Turner. So certainly, yes, the way he worked and the fact that nowadays we can see all his studies and the colour beginnings and the almost abstract works that really would have just stayed in portfolios in his own studio during his lifetime. They wouldn't have been publicly seen. But we view them now and they have that same effect, I suppose, as some of the works by the French Impressionists.
And Charlotte, it is interesting the way even the centuries after his death, he was still being championed by different generations of artists and critics who continued to recognise his genius.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think really for every age, there is a Turner, you know, because he bequeathed his collection, his studio collection to the nation. It's now held by Tate Britain in London. And so there are thousands and thousands of his works on paper, his unfinished oils. We have this very wide knowledge of his work. And from that, people are constantly discovering new elements. So, for example, when his oil paintings were first properly catalogued in the early 20th century, it was at a moment where audiences in Britain were discovering Impressionism, basically. So their eyes were quite attuned to these more looser and more expressive works, which the Victorian audience would have found difficult to deal with. And similarly, I mean, Anne mentioned Mark Rothko. Well, Turner was exhibited at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in the 1960s alongside Rothko. And I think now scholars are studying Turner's interest in the environment and climate change. So I think that it is a constant process of renewal. There is something in Turner's work for everyone, whatever your taste is, because he was so intellectually engaged and so kind of artistically experimental.
So Anne, how would you assess his legacy then?
His legacy is immense. The very fact that he's a household name, I think, you know, many people would only be familiar with maybe a handful of artists, and Turner is certainly one of them. And the crowds of people who come every year to view the exhibitions in Dublin and in Edinburgh is testament to his legacy. Certainly, as an artist, he has inspired other artists right through the generations, both while he was alive and afterwards.
And Charlotte, in terms of his reputation, in terms of his legacy, on this, the 250th anniversary of his birth, how should we view Turner? Should we view him as this creative, experimental artist who has become one of the recognised globally as one of the great artists of time, someone whose works will still be studied, will still be viewed, will still be enjoyed 250 years from now?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think the more time one spends with Turner, the more one studies his work, the more one comes to love it, really. I mean, I feel that from working on the collection here and from researching Turner's work. But I also hear that from people who come every year to see the Vaughan Turners being exhibited. And Turner, I mean, massively influential on other artists still. People go and study his technique. But ultimately, I think looking at Turner's work is life-enhancing as well. The colour, the light, the expression, and the inspiration are all fantastic things.
Okay, well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion of Turner, and a reminder, of course, that these wonderful exhibitions running until the 31st of January, and the one in Ireland taking place in the Print Gallery in the National Gallery of Ireland. Well, my thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Anne Hodge, the creator of Prints and Drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland, Charlotte Topsfield, the senior creator of British Prints and Drawings at the National Galleries of Scotland, and Niamh McGuinn, paper conservator at the National Gallery of Ireland. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer Marisa Sullivan and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.